Welcome to Red Flags Rising. My name is Mike Hunneke. I am the co-chair of the Sanctions, Export Controls, and AML Practice Group at Hughes, Subbard & Reed. I'm joined yet again by my good friend, Brent Carlson, a director at the Berkeley Research Group. Today is Tuesday, June 17th, just after 4:15 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. Brent, how are you doing today?
Excellent. Thanks, Mike. Great to be here and talk about the important issues of the day, as always.
Well, Brent, one issue that we thought would be particularly interesting to our listeners and also very timely is the escalating conflict between Israel and Iran, not only from its geopolitical and military significance, but really from its significance on export controls.
You know, over the last few days, there's literally an explosion of tensions between Iran and Israel. This conflict has really escalated in recent days. President Trump is weighing whether or not the United States is going to get involved. No matter what's going to happen at the end of the day, there's going to be fallout in terms of impact on global companies in terms of export controls and sanctions. There was a really good article that the Dow Jones Risk Journal put out just a couple days ago. It was on Friday, June 13th, just after Israel and Iran started to exchange fire. It talks about risks for companies coming out of this. Again, no matter where this conflict is going to end, this is going to have a broad fallout. It's good to explore that a little bit. There's some really great quotes in this article, including quotes from yourself. It's important to unpack key areas that companies and their legal and compliance teams should pay attention to.
Richard Vanderford, one of the authors of the article, he's done a lot of interesting work focusing on some of the unanticipated or unexpected consequences of export controls and sanctions. The angle here that I thought was particularly interesting from the perspective of companies is, well, what's going to happen next? Israel has just destroyed equipment, ballistic missiles, presumably things related to ballistic missiles, things related to the nuclear program sites that they're targeting. We're going to see Iran try to replace this. This is exactly what happened after the October airstrikes by Israel targeting Iran's ballistic missile production. Companies who produce dual-use items, some of which may not really anticipate that they are going to be on the front lines of the conflict in the Middle East, need to be prepared for what will seem as amazing business opportunities that will come to their attention. The greatest risk from this conflict is not some new controls that might be put in place and not new sanctions, because I think those have been essentially exhausted as to Iran itself, but too good to be true opportunities, amazing opportunities where somebody wants an item, somebody wants parts or service on an urgent basis, they're willing to overpay for it, they are willing to waive any warranty over the services or over the equipment. It will sound like an amazing deal for whichever sales employee gets the call. If something is too good to be true, it is. We have seen in the past Iran use straw men, intermediary companies, in order to try to procure parts for military or WMD purposes. They never call and say, "Hi, I'm calling on behalf of the Ayatollah. We need this machine or we need X," right? It's somebody who is in maybe a NATO country, especially like Turkey. Maybe it's somebody in the United States. Recently, there was a case of a gentleman named Ray Hunt in Alabama, who in February was sentenced to 5 years in prison because he was actually procuring tools for the Iranian regime. He said that companies in the UAE were the end users of his equipment. Well, trading companies in the UAE are not end users. They're never end users of anything. Their whole business is to be trading companies. So if you see something that has an FZE after it or a GTC in the company name, maybe it's a legitimate distributor or reseller. But before you sell something to that person or that entity around any type of conflict like what we're seeing now in the Middle East, be very careful about it and be sure that you can document for the United States government, if they come asking you about it, why you thought this distributor or this reseller was legitimate and that they weren't going to just pass it on, whether it's to Iran directly from them or through China or through some other place. It puts a little bit of an additional burden on companies, but you do not want to be in a situation 3 months from now, 4 months from now, when you have the Bureau of Industry and Security, maybe with the Federal Bureau of Investigation in tow, asking you, "Hey, why did you think this sale was okay? And tell us more about your compliance program."
You make a good point. We're talking here of nuclear facilities and missiles. Help us unpack a little bit that catch-all controls.
Putting aside item classification, if it's an export from the United States, if it's, quote, subject to the Export Administration regulations as a result, even if it's a paperclip, if it's being sent for a prohibited end use or to a prohibited end user, a license would be required. Now, in those contexts, in a way, as we've talked about before regarding the catch-all provisions, I think the Bureau of Industry and Security thinks it's helping companies out by qualifying those regulations with a knowledge element. So they're not strict liability in terms of what you are aware of. BIS would have to show, even to impose a civil monetary penalty, knowledge. Now, Brent, what does knowledge mean under the EAR? The full definition of knowledge includes not only actual knowledge, it includes reason to know, which is the same standard we see in the sanctions regimes managed by OFAC. It also includes an awareness of a high probability. If you get an urgent phone call and someone is, again, offering you that unbelievable, unprecedented business opportunity, but they need it right away, be really careful. Where something is new, where the trade flow is unusual, where the quantity is unusual, that's the type of thing where, again, in the worst case scenario where it goes to a bad place, the government is going to say, how could you possibly have thought this was normal? The catch-all provisions, Brent, that you raise cover a lot of ground. It's not only ballistic missiles or UAV, it's also biological weapons programs, chemical weapons programs, and nuclear programs.
It seems like the U.S. government has really upped its game in terms of understanding and mapping global trade flows and certain pieces of equipment that will go into these type of facilities. Companies know your own business. And if this stuff goes into these type of facilities, then any new business that comes out of the blue should be scrutinized very heavily, because you could get an outreach visit real easy, followed by other steps that the U.S. government could take, like an administrative subpoena from BIS as well, if one's not careful.
Yeah, absolutely, Brent. One of our favorite Delaware Chancery Court decisions in the McDonald's case includes a quote by the vice chancellor that red flags do indeed come out of the blue, and they could here as well. When you're talking about program design, that's one thing, it's forward-looking. When you're talking about an allegation, an alert that you might receive, a red flag, you have an obligation to respond to that in an appropriate way. There's red flags that you might get, there's red flags that the government might get. You're absolutely right to point out that there's been a significant increase in what the U.S. government is sharing publicly about its capabilities in this regard over the last couple of years. Certainly, if something is commercially available, as far as tracing and tracking information, the U.S. government is at least going to have the same information, and we should assume maybe a little bit better.
From that experience of Ukraine-related diversion, at the end of the day, that was really a China story. I mean, that diversion was either coming from or through Greater China. I think that's kind of what we expect to see here, because at the end of the day, who's Iran's largest trading partner? That's People's Republic of China. There's another aspect in all this in terms of risk that will impact or could impact companies from this conflict between Israel and Iran. That comes from some reporting today on the Wall Street Journal. According to the Israeli Defense Force, Iran has launched approximately 370 ballistic missiles in recent days. Now, Israel's defense forces have intercepted 90% of them. What that means is about 30 of them have made it through and struck Israel. So like we saw in Ukraine, where the Ukrainians then took apart whatever components survived, we could be looking at a situation here where the Israeli defense forces are doing the same thing with those missiles that struck Israel.
Absolutely, Brent. And I think we should all assume that's already being done, not only just from a military and tactical perspective. You know, what are we dealing with? What capabilities do these missiles have in terms of guidance, in terms of electronic warfare? But specifically, how did they build these and with what, from whom? I would not want to be somebody who is found to have supplied the critical components of an Iranian ballistic missile that's recovered in Tel Aviv. I think that in addition to whatever the Israeli defense forces might do trying to trace back things, I expect that we'll see in the coming weeks or months reports about how Iran built these missiles. Now, maybe it's going to look a lot like what we saw in Ukraine already, if it's coming from some of the same procurement networks and things like that. There was a position taken regarding some of the recoveries in Russia. Well, maybe they stockpiled things. Maybe these are things they built before sanctions went into place. It's going to be very hard to make that argument as far as Iran goes.
Given the comprehensive embargo for decades.
For decades, right? That's a complex issue for companies to navigate.
And raise questions on the effectiveness of their export controls compliance programs as well.
Right. That gets again to the high probability standard, which really in some ways is a curse, but is also a benefit to companies. The curse is that the government can make probabilistic charging decisions, but the benefit is that companies can point to it as a tool they can use to make and defend risk-based decisions about where they look and how hard they look from a compliance perspective.
In this Dow Jones Risk Journal article that we talk about, somebody also said that it is unlikely that the U.S. will step up its efforts to address perceived gaps in enforcement. I don't agree with that statement. Come on. What do you think is happening here? This is full-on military conflict that cuts to the core of the national security of the United States, Israel, and to other countries that face the risk of a nuclear-armed Iran. This is a little bit of a legacy view where we've seen some people say that they're taking a wait-and-see approach in terms of enforcement. In this world that we are in, there's only one way for this to go. Or we just throw in the towel and give up.
Well, Brent, I don't think we're going to do that. I don't think this president is going to do that based on some of the statements he's been posting to social media just today.
No way.
This administration has already announced and acted upon a maximum strategy regarding Iran. If you're going to poke the regulators in the eye by saying that you're curious or skeptical, as some people have said in the past, or take a wait and see approach and kind of challenge them to bring it, they're going to bring it.
This is not the world it was 15 years ago. It's totally different.
There are so many levers that haven't been pulled that could be pulled, including, frankly, the high probability standard. We saw in the America First trade policy, the president asked the secretaries of state and commerce to give him a report on what are the loopholes and how we close them. You and I have talked about how a lot of times those loopholes aren't really loopholes. And so the closing of the loopholes does not require regulatory action by BIS, certainly not legislative action by Congress. If the Bureau of Industry and Security and its Office of Export Enforcement think there's a perception that there's a gap in enforcement and that that's having a national security impact either directly on the United States or on our friends and allies, I expect them to rise to the challenge of bringing enforcement action on that point. This administration, Brent, has made a public commitment to dismantle Iran's nuclear program. The president has called for Iran initially to come back to the table, but or more recently to abandon its nuclear program. I don't think we should anticipate, and I certainly wouldn't suggest to companies that they anticipate that there's a lack of will on the part of the administration to do whatever it thinks it needs to do to promote these policy objectives. We've seen also the administration be, frankly, very creative when we talk about, for example, secondary tariffs that they warned about in the context of countries willing to continue to trade in Venezuelan oil. If we've learned anything from the first several months of this administration, it's to expect the unexpected. Just because someone has not done something before is not going to be a reason why they won't do it this time. That leads us to Brent Carlson's Managing Up. Brent, what is your Managing Up thought for the day?
Not only has the world changed, the pace of change has become non-linear. We're in a situation now where massive swerves can come unexpectedly at any moment. Now is the time to reassess our export controls and sanctions, diversion risks, before the U.S. government comes and does it for us.
Very well said, Brent. If you are in a situation where you can take a deliberate, thoughtful, and risk-based approach to assessing your trade compliance risks in this new environment, it is a luxury to be able to do that at your own time, at your own pace, and really in a collaborative environment with your management, your C-suite, with your board. Now is the time to take a fresh look at where those risks are and how you can show to the government later, if asked, here's where we drew the lines, here's why we drew them there.
Take the initiative. Take the initiative to take a fresh look. It'll pay out in spades.
Exactly. Well, Brent, that concludes this episode of Red Flags Rising. Be well.
Thanks, Mike. These are challenging times for everyone, but with the right moves, we can all get through it together. Be well.